The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Michael Clark of Duane Morris in Houston, Texas, on the Dodd-Frank Act, and in particular the whistleblower or bounty hunter provisions of the Act. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Michael E. Clark practices in the area of litigation with concentrations in securities and financial fraud, as well as white-collar law and healthcare law in both criminal and civil matters. Mr. Clark's been lead counsel in more than 100 jury trials. He's counseled clients, including healthcare providers, insurers, and financial institutions, helping to conduct internal investigations and advising on compliance and corporate governance matters. He serves on the planning committees for the American Bar Association's upcoming National Institute on Securities Fraud and the National Institute on Internal Investigations and In-House Counsel. He's the immediate past chair of the White Collar Crime Committee in the ABA section of business law. Mr. Clark frequently writes and presents on antitrust, corporate compliance and governance, ethics, internal investigations, pharmaceutical law, securities law, and white-collar defense issues. Mr. Clark, it's a pleasure to have you with us on this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The Dodd-Frank Act has been the topic of discussion for a number of our LexisNexis Legal Podcasts. It was July 21st, 2010, when President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. If you could, Mr. Clark, kind of give us a little bit of general background on some of the major provisions of this legislation.
Happy to do it. You know, looking at this legislation is reminiscent for me of what happened not too terribly long ago with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. You had a huge piece of legislation that was ramrodded through Congress that on reflection is so dense and has so many different provisions in it that it takes time to kind of evaluate and study it. In my firm, for example, we've had 14 separate contributions trying to analyze the act from different standpoints. But just to kind of give you an idea of the scope of it, the legislation requires that new and existing regulatory agencies undertake over 50 studies of the financial system, and they are charged with rulemaking in the magnitude of about 250 new rules that they have to craft and implement in the next 270 days or thereabouts. 18 months out is the furthest out. So it's massive, and it came as a direct consequence of what we've been experiencing of late, which is the financial collapse, if you would, that brought us on the brink, some would argue, of depression, but at least into a very severe recession that we're still trying to emerge from. So in my part of the contribution, I looked at what some people thought was kind of a sleeper provision, which was the new SEC and CFTC bounty provisions. But let me kind of tell you how we in my firm have broken it out. One aspect of the act is the regulation of derivatives and swap trading provisions, and that was something that became problematic in the economic collapse that we experienced because the derivatives got out of control and people didn't really understand the trading instruments that were going on, particularly in the subprime market. So in the regulation of derivatives and swap trading provisions, the act provides for sweeping reforms, which includes such things as substantial regulation of over-the-counter derivative markets, and now financial institutions that fit within the Act's definition of a swap dealer or a major swap participant is going to be subject to a new requirement that could include registration, capital and margin requirements, reporting, record keeping, as well as new business conduct standards prohibiting entities from dealing what are characterized as abusive swaps. The idea is that financial institutions will be required to push out many derivatives, separately capitalize affiliates, and just try to get a handle on what has been seen as a risk or a hole in the financial regulatory web that needed attention. A second part in the legislation, it impacts the so-called Volcker rule and improvements in the regulation of banking entities and non-bank financial companies. And basically under the Volcker rules, this act has a section 619 which requires banking entities, including insured depository institutions, holding companies, and their bank and non-bank affiliates and subs, they're going to be limited in engaging in proprietary trading. Otherwise, that's kind of a definition for engaging in the trading account of an entity in a transaction to buy or sell a security. So that's new. The Act also includes a provision for the so-called too-big-to-fail bailout avoidance provisions. And, you know, we've seen a lot of entities that got federal funds, not that the government really wanted to, but felt like it had to move in to avoid a systemic collapse. GM comes to mind. And the whole idea of government ownership of private entities is kind of repugnant generally, and there's lots of reasons why we should be very careful about doing that. There's a creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Title 10 of the Dodd-Frank Act establishes the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. It's going to have the authority to regulate and enforce substantial standards for anybody that engages in an offer or sale of a financial product or service to a consumer. It's going to enforce consumer financial laws in several ways, has the power to assess civil money penalties ranging up to $1 million a day in some cases, disgorgement for unjust enrichment and restitution, and we'll have the typical regulatory powers, demand documents, information, issue subpoenas, have hearings, adjudications, issue cease and desist orders, and commence civil actions. Fifth on the list, the registration of advisors to private investment funds and pools and small advisory firms. The Act has eliminated the decades-old exemption from investment advisor registration for small advisory firms and for advisors to private investment funds, and will require thousands of firms to register now. But, you know, beyond the fact of registration, the firms will become subject to the pervasive regulatory scheme that limits incentive-based compensation, requires detailed reporting and documentation, and imposes other restrictions on other common business practices. There's a creation of the Federal Insurance Office and the Financial Stability Oversight Council. There are now capital requirements or new capital requirements for financial institutions, part of Title I of the Act. There's modifications to the U.S. Federal Reserve's Emergency Lending Authority. In particular, it limits the Fed's ability to lend to individual companies outside a program or facility that provides for broad-based eligibility. This is designed ostensibly to prevent the possibility of cherry-picking one company over another on an individual basis. There is another part, the Consumer Financial Protection Act of 2010, which institutes the first federal regulation of debit card interchange fees. There's corporate governance and executive compensation provisions for public companies. Generally, again, more transparency for people that invest in companies on executive compensation disclosure, things of that nature. There's mortgage reform measures and an Anti-Predatory Lending Act part, that's Title 14, which sets forth minimum underwriting standards for home mortgages and requires lenders to ensure a borrower's creditworthiness. And that goes back to the whole subprime mortgage market debacle and some of the problems that came to light with that collapse. Part 12, as we see it, municipal securities. The Act has established the Office of Municipal Securities within the SEC to administer the rules of the SEC about the practices of municipal securities brokers, dealers, and advisors, and to coordinate with the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, rulemaking and enforcement actions. Credit rating agencies, this part of the Act responds to the part that credit rating agencies had played or were perceived to have played in the recent financial crisis. The SEC is to promulgate regulations within a year. The SEC will have a newly created Office of Credit Ratings to oversee, and the regulations here, again, are designed to achieve transparency. Then the part that I have focused on is the Act's new bounty hunter and expanded bounty hunter provisions. These are designed to increase the voluntary reporting of securities and commodity violations, and Congress did so by essentially monetizing or giving bounties to people that would bring to the government's attention problems that they see that they can substantiate.
I want to get into that section a little bit more in a moment or two, but if I may put in a plug for you folks, all of those 14 issues are outlined in a paper on the firm website, at DwayneMorris.com, and you can drill down into each one individually to get even more detail. And I have to say, it's very in-depth, very comprehensive, has a great deal of information for people to look at.
Thank you, Steve. A lot of work went into it, and you know, we're going to try to update it as these things come down, because, as I said, there's going to be a lot of rulemaking coming down, and we're not going to necessarily know all the nuances of this until we get an idea of what the rules are going to look like.
Yeah, exactly. How did the financial crisis bring about the call for such dramatic reform?
Well, you know, whenever you have the economy tank and people are looking for who to hold responsible, there's always a political aspect that kicks in, and that's where Congress gets involved. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley is the most recent before this that I can recall, and you know, it's the same scenario. We had post 9/11, we had some major problems that came about with Enron and you know, some of the other companies, Adelphia, that we had discovered that there were things that were happening that were, you know, intolerable in the public's eye. And so at some point then you say, who can we hold responsible? Where do the rules need to be tightened? What can we do to ensure that this never happens again? And you know, we look at Sarbanes-Oxley, and it was incredibly comprehensive, Steve, but there again, the problem is you can enact lots of rules, lots of regulations, lots of new standards, and that's what Sarbanes-Oxley did. You know, new expanded reporting requirements, quicker reporting requirements, and yet we have now, post-Sarbanes-Oxley, this collapse. And so it's a cycle that we see over and over again, it appears, but here it's hard to say that there wasn't a need to identify some fixes that could be done, or hopeful fixes, to at least let the public believe that something is being done to rectify a problem that everybody agreed was far out of control.
You mentioned the section of the paper that's on the firm's website that you worked on, the whistleblower incentives and protections. Do you see the bounty hunter provisions of Dodd-Frank designed to increase voluntary reporting of securities and commodities violations as the real meat of this legislation?
You know, it certainly caught my attention, but there's other provisions that I think one could argue, depending on your framework, are equally meaty, Steve. The, you know, the regulation of mortgage lending is crucial. The regulation of derivative swaps, it's undeniably important. But, you know, the general theme here, again, is that each of these provisions has tightened up the regulation and oversight incrementally. What I thought is a game changer in this part that I wrote about is that it's designed, and, you know, based on my past experience with similar provisions and other statutes, I think it will be a game changer. I think it's a sea change for enforcement, because it's an actual incentivization, if you would, of the private sector to come in and blow the whistle on entities that may have otherwise escaped attention. And this was a direct consequence of the Bernie Madoff scandal that got the SEC a lot of criticism. I'm going to call to your attention something that I don't think I mentioned in the part that I contributed, but there was a report that was issued in March of 2009 by the Inspector General's Office for the SEC, and essentially it was assessing the then-existing SEC bounty program, and that was limited only to insider trading. It's been around for 20-odd years, but was very little used. And so, to some extent, this really is an SEC wish list, and they really think that this is going to work. They were saying, let's look at some of the models of other programs that have been quite successful, and the one that I use as the analogy is the Federal Civil False Claims Act and its so-called QI-TAM provisions, which are the whistleblower provisions, and those provisions have been incredibly successful since 1986 when that legislation was reformed. The amount of monies that have been brought to the federal government are in the multitudes of billions. The number of enforcement activities have increased in areas where the False Claims Act has had a lot of emphasis. Healthcare in particular has seen a whole lot of new enforcement actions brought by insiders who are frankly incentivized to blow the whistle because they can become multimillionaires.
But what are some of the issues that you see arising for publicly traded companies in the areas of compliance and corporate governance and internal investigations?
Well, you know, I've been corresponding and dialoguing with counsel that I know that do the same type of work that I do, and the difficulty is how do you properly disincentivize people that are going to be whistleblowers? How do you do that in light of the fact that they have new and added protections? It comes down to how do you instill an ethical compliance culture? How do you make sure that people understand that this is not window dressing, but this is part and parcel of good corporate citizenship? I think that the impact is going to be that one way you can address the problem is to go back in and carefully review your existing compliance and governance mechanisms. There are, for example, in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act area, there are some pretty good programs out there that lets companies self-assess the magnitude of their risk, but publicly traded companies that are involved in multinational activities are at real risk of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act investigations in this day and age in particular. And that's one area that I wrote about that everybody seems to agree that this is a heightened risk area because the government has put substantial resources into this area. And, you know, for good reason, quite frankly, corruption in governments is not good for anybody. And whatever we can do to avoid that is critical. But the problem is with that particular statute that it is so vaguely written, there have been so few cases that have gone to trial that, you know, there's not a whole lot of black letter law, so to speak. And so what you have to do prophylactically is to make sure that you stay on top of these issues, that you have the requisite bells and whistles, and then some. So how do you disincentivize people? Honesty, integrity, transparency, periodic testing, exit interviews of employees, things of that nature that just have to be done.
There are so many parts of this to analyze. We could do a separate podcast on each one of them that you folks at the firm have written about. But given that, how long do you think it will be before we start to see some results or an impact?
Well, I think it's already starting. I know that the SEC and the Peacock matter issued a press release, you know, shortly after Dodd-Frank kicked in, saying that they had rewarded a whistleblower with $1 million bounty, if you would, and made reference to the fact that this was under the old regime, but that the new regime is substantially broader and substantially more lucrative.
Almost like here's some incentive for you.
Yeah. So there's been a couple of cases out there now that are already being considered. But, you know, one of the questions in light of the legislation's recent enactment, is it prospective or is it potentially retroactive? And I don't think it's retroactive, clearly, but if you had conduct that had been ongoing and then it continues into the date when the act kicks in, one could argue that, you know, that is now actionable. So I don't think that it's clear whether the rulemaking is going to change much here, but I think that companies are now at risk for it. And again, you know, I noticed that people are out there advertising for these cases and do a Google search for SEC bounty or SEC whistleblower, and you'll get on Google, not trying to plug Google, but if you do a search on that, you'll see some pretty recognizable large firms that are out there now touting their experience in similar cases.
So what are the prospects for litigation over some of these issues?
That's a great question. Moving backwards and comparing this to you know, what has been out there, you had the class action counsel that would oftentimes file class action suits in the aftermath of an announced government action or a disclosure of a restatement or something along those lines. But they have to be, you know, looking at this with particular interest because this doesn't require them to file a lawsuit. All they have to do is to find a plaintiff that has original information, which is a defined term. That just essentially means that somebody has independent knowledge or has information that wasn't known to the commission from another source. And, you know, if they can convince the agency to move forward on the enforcement action, keeping anonymity basically until the government says we're going to move forward, then there's no real financial investment of the same magnitude. You know, class action counsel have to go through and get approval to have the class certified, then they have to have approval to be lead counsel in a class action, and they have to fight hard and deal with, you know, problems that are sometimes insurmountable because of the heightened pleading standards for private securities under the Private Litigation Securities Reform Act of 1995. So to me, and this is just educated speculation, if you would, but why wouldn't a class action counsel at least start looking into this area, because you don't have the costs, nor do you have the costs, Steve, that a whistleblower has to bear under the Federal False Claims Act, because under that act, you also have to go through and file litigation under seal and get the government to adopt it. But along the way, defense counsel at some point will realize that there's a matter there, and they're going to fight tooth and nails to get the case out, thrown out on procedural issues. But here, you don't need to file a lawsuit.
It'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 12, 18 months or so.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. And, you know, it's still somewhat novel, although a lot of lawyers are starting to look into it and trying to advise their clients about it. It's still, I don't think, that widely known. And, you know, once it kind of filters down into the would-be whistleblower world, you know, the folks that are otherwise in a position where they can get information that may be disgruntled or whatever their motivation might be, you know, who wants to be a millionaire comes to my mind.
Yeah. Any final thoughts as we close on the act in general, or the, in particular, the bounty hunter provisions?
Well, I think that the important thing, the large takeaway from this is that if you look at other areas where there's been similar motivation, the growth has been exponential in the enforcement arena. So here, what you're going to probably end up seeing, and I think this is designed to do, is to get the larger cases in the door for the SEC. The act says that it has to be a violation that results in a penalty of at least $1 million in penalties. So it's designed to kind of separate the bad cases or the smaller cases, and the idea is to bring to light the really large cases. And the thing that I think that I find very difficult long-term is, will this have a good effect in corporate citizenship or not? Because how can you prevent somebody from being disloyal to a company? The really only option a company has, if there is a whistleblower in their midst at this point, is to go ahead and try to self-disclose as quickly as they can to ensure that the information is not original. And, of course, when you do that, you have all sorts of a parade of terribles that kick in, like, you know, you have to publicly report what's happened. You can expect to have, you know, your shares drop in value, and the ripple effects can be very dramatic. But at some point, that becomes a tough decision that has to be made.
Not a pleasant scenario.
Not for businesses, no. I think it's going to increase the cost of compliance, and you know, that gets passed along to the consumers at some point.
Mr. Clark, appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us about the Act and about these provisions in particular. Appreciate your time and being part of this LexisNexis Legal Podcast.
I'm delighted to have the invitation. I hope it's been helpful.
Michael Clark, Duane Morris in Houston. Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis Legal Podcast. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions. I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.